101.3 FM. Coming up, Bathrop Spears Broadsides, a 10 o'clock debate with council member and mayor, well, former mayor, Mike Rodkin. Stay with us. Generation recording of Phil Free and Jess Kidden, Sleep on the Mayor's Lawn. Gosh, back in the early to mid-90s, that number was recorded. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. This is the usual Sunday morning, 3.5 hours of, well, your input, my output, a bit of music here and there, but mostly commentary and concern about local civil rights issues. So this is your chance to get on the record and also to get, particularly this morning, city council members on the record, at least one of them, Mike Rodkin. Some would say it's a broken record, but that's for you to judge. The debate is going to begin, well, I should say the interrogation is going to begin at 10 o'clock. The participants haven't reached the studio yet, and I'm getting ready to do it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play an interview with Berkeley poet Julia Vinograd, a really wonderful poet, writes a lot about the streets. I've had her on the show before by phone. She's lived in Berkeley for, gosh, I don't know, 50 years now. She's written more than 40, 45 books. And this is an interview from a couple months ago, which I was able finally to dig up. You're going to get the benefit of kind of hearing a little poetry before we get into the grim and brutal prose. So stay with us. If you want to phone in, you can call at 427-3772. Calls are going to be, on this one occasion, screened because we're going to try to keep up the flow of this debate, of this panel of investigation, you might say, into the human rights situation in Santa Cruz and the positions of Mike Rodkin. Some would say the culpability of Mike Rodkin. He's graciously agreed to come on the show voluntarily. We didn't have to arrest him and bring him in. And the number to call is 427-3772 if you want to make a question or comment, which we may not be able to air directly. If we don't, you're welcome to call back after the entire debate is over for a more extended commentary. That should be after 11:15 sometime. You can also email in at rnorse2, R-N-O-R-S-E, number 2, numeral 2, at hotmail.com, rnorse2 at hotmail.com, and I will be checking that to see any incoming emails and passing on questions there when we can. So that's going to be repeated before the 10 o'clock session begins. But first, Julia Vinograd. were up here at the Cafe Met in Berkeley on September 10th, 2003.
Two new poems from the Great Spirit and one that hasn't been out yet. For a friend arrested at a peace demonstration. I spent the last 14 hours in jail, he announced, all grinning and rumpled, black unwashed curls. Yeros get coffee? I got him coffee. Tell me about it, I asked. Well, he gulped his macchiato. We were in the street, and I couldn't see anyway, so I thought, I'll do a Ginsburg. So I sat down, crossed my arms, put my hands in the, crossed my legs, put my hands out, and pretty soon we were all holding hands. And then the mounted police came, and I was sitting in front of a horse. You know, he interrupted himself with a small sip of coffee. A horse really is hung like a horse. I thought it was just a way of talking. They packed us into the vans. Fire regulations would close a nightclub down for that many people. It almost felt like a nightclub. They separated the men and women at the holding station. We all sang God Bless America. It made the guards wonderfully grumpy. And the girls all sang Itsy Bitsy Spider. There must have been beautiful girls to make Itsy Bitsy Spider ring like the Liberty Bell. We talked all night, like Socrates or Kerouac or Bugs Bunny. Even in jail, no one could catch us. But jail food sucks. In the morning, I got out and got myself breakfast and wrote this poem. He pulled yellow notepaper from his pocket and sent lines spinning like frisbees. Then the coffee house door burst open, and a 19-year-old girl, bare feet, bare arms, short black hair, short black dress, bounced in out of breath. Hey, you guys, she insisted. Do either of you have a condom? Yeah, my friend said, a little shook. Do you want two? She gave him a special just-for-you smile. Oh, yes, she said, and ran out. Freedom, I sighed and drank my coffee. Oh, yes, he said, and watched the light dancing where her footprints had been.
And that was from?
The latest Street Spirit, and so is the next one.
The name of the poem?
For a friend arrested at the peace demonstration.
Go ahead. Give me another one.
War dogs. In a corner of paradise, 11-year-old angels sit on the crumbling, vine-covered walls, blowing up balloons and playing kickball with them, bare toes on stars or swirling colors. In the garden, a pack of slavering, bloody-mouthed, barking dogs try to burst the balloons of angel breath, long, yellow teeth over mouths of broken bones. The dogs are wars, so busy shooting down each other's planes that they can't jump high as even the lowest, teasing balloons. The angels giggle at them, and somehow the war dogs hear it through all the landmines, itching like ringworms, and the barking tanks. They've got to get the balloons. They've got to get the angels, and they wind up only getting each other. The war dogs bang their fortified heads against the walls, and apple blossoms drift over them, stained by the blood of soldiers for a second, and then white again. This is paradise, and the angels wriggle their toes and kick all their balloons away. Then the angels go make their face bloody with strawberry jam and lick it off. The war dogs weep because the angels got away, and the war dogs kill everyone who sees them weeping.
War Dogs by Julia Vinograd in the current issue of Street Spirit. We'll see. Now we have something you actually, you're whipping out your own manuscript.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This is handwritten and everything.
Actually, I want to know that this poem, Limbo Town, actually is one of George's favorites. George, you're an old People's Park activist. You've gone off to Vermont. We hope this machine continues to work.
So, yeah, I'm in Vermont. What?
You're visiting town. You're picking up a few of your favorite poems.
I am in town, and I hang around with Julia because I had a lot of pleasure looking at her new poetry, which I missed in the last year or so. And this is one that particularly drew my attention.
Okay. Limbo Town, go ahead.
All right. Limbo Town. Go down Limbo Town, drink all night. Your money's no good, neither are you. Leave your mind behind on a bar for a feather boa waitress as the fog comes due. Your money's no good, neither are you. Everything they say is true, but nobody listens in Limbo Town. Go down Limbo Town with a red lantern looking for a lie, a juicy lie that doesn't know your name. X marks the girl, the barker bites the moon. You tell everyone you'll be leaving soon, but nobody listens in Limbo Town. Go down Limbo Town, take a chair, pour sand through your hands, forget why you're there. Birds fly out of pool balls, nobody cares, neither do you. They've taken your drink away, In Limbo Town, they've taken it all away.
Limbo Town. You got some other stuff in there that you haven't let us see yet?
I just read 3 pieces.
It's true, but we're trying to, you know, you're not going to be publishing a book this year, I understand, because of some medical problems and also personal.
I had a cataract operation, and I'm having landlord trouble.
Looking for a new place? Should we put out the call here?
No, I'm trying to hold on to my old place. The landlords are trying to make the rent go up like $150. They're capitally improving people who really don't want to be capitally improved.
How long have you lived in this place?
About 10 years, a little over. But these are new landlords.
Wow. And is this an example of what's going on in Berkeley generally? Yeah. Gentrification?
Yes. There isn't even much that the rent board can do about it. Capital improvements is a loophole. And it's, you know, we've had meetings and stuff, but they're very rich lawyers.
This is actually a place that has a lot of low-income people in it.
Oh, yes. Lots and lots. I mean, the old landlord, half the building, he was charging people, I was paying $35 less than the rent control said, you know, a minimum. And I know people who are paying $45 less. Half the building, you know, he was making allowances for. He owned a lot of buildings, and I think, you know, if he didn't like people or if we amused him, he didn't really care. He wasn't about to go broke.
And this landlord is gone, and we have a new landlord.
Yeah.
You got a new poem?
Yeah, you got me interested.
Thumbing through a well-worn notebook here, which I couldn't decipher even.
The trouble is, neither can I. I usually read stuff that has been at least semi-typed. I'm trying to find a. Oh God.
How long does it take you to write a poem?
It depends on the poem. Some come out.
Limbo Town. How long did that take?
That one was fast. Actually, I could. This is a curious thing. I guess it's just called Old Woman. There's an old woman. She eats things. Not the usual things either. I saw her on a bus bench, plucking at the lace collar of her striped dress with her threaded, twisted claws because the day was so hot. The next time I passed, the bus bench was gone. Of course, the city's always taking out benches so the drunks won't sleep on them, and I can't prove anything, but she eats things. I saw her about to cross the street, leaning on a cane so old and bent it might have been her twin. The light was green, but a screeching fire engine made her wait till the light turned red and then green again. The next day, the local news joked about a fire engine gone missing. How could anything big, bright, and noisy as a fire engine get lost? Was that driver ever in trouble when he came back from his joyride? It hasn't come back. She eats things. I've never seen her shopping, only using a shop window for a mirror and smiling. Face all wrinkles and crow's feet, and the crow itself looks from her eyes. Thick white braids pinned on her hair like a helmet. Never saw her wear a hat. Most ladies wear hats. And always that one dress, always clean. A dog barked at her. A week later, I saw an old flyer offering a reward, lost puppy. The paper was already yellow and torn. So far, I think it's random. She carries a shiny black vinyl purse like so many other ladies. I can't prove there's nothing in her purse but a stone wrapped in dried leaves. She eats things. She'd eat Mount Everest because it's there. But nothing satisfies. She's trying to remember. I don't think she's noticed people yet.
And that's called?
Old Woman. I've got a list for her, but I suspect everybody has another separate list.
And?
By indirection.
These are poems you've written recently?
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, yes. Here's one. It's the Statue of Liberty poem. Statue of Liberty, she traded her fiery torch in on a torch song. My sweet America left me. She sings in a little dive, where the drunks complain her drapery isn't tight enough and her skirts are too low. Okay, she's got a pretty face, but they didn't come here to look at faces. America left her for a sexy national security dominatrix with chains, a whalebone black lace corset, and so many people in jail just for looking at her funny. Statue of Liberty, her stone feet don't fit in spike-heeled boots. Looking for squealing necks. When he left, America told her he'd always remember her, but things were different now. She didn't understand him anymore. She could tell. The sight of her bored him. He couldn't wait to get away. The club owner thought she'd bring in a bigger crowd. He was planning on buying some other freaks from the circus to be her backup band, but it isn't working out. If she loses her job, how will she pay for the furnished room where she goes to hide her memories and stare at the walls all night with empty eyes? She can't stop thinking about her sweet America. Why did he leave her, and what is he doing now?
Beautiful.
So, you're here at your old haunt here in the Café Med. How long have you been here, and when are you going to choose a new café?
You mean with more people in it? It wouldn't hurt. Well,
less noisy espresso machines.
All espresso machines are noisy, but I could use more people so I could sell more books. On the other hand, this one is right next door to Moe's, and I'm kind of addicted to Moe's.
I've noticed there's some coffee shops down on Shattuck, Jumpin' Java, and a couple of others I never even knew existed before.
I haven't tried them out. Where's Jumpin' Java?
Near the Ashkenaz, only a couple blocks toward Oakland. I don't mean the Ashkenaz, I mean the long haul.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Ashkenaz is North Berkeley. I don't do North Berkeley.
So anyway, hey, Julia, thank you. If people want to get your poetry or your CDs, and you have not only Bubbles and Bones on CD as well as Eye of the Hand, you have a new, the Book of Jerusalem. That's something you wrote, in the early 70s?
George didn't forget it, did he?
I think he's still... He's right outside.
Yeah, so he'll be back.
So how can they get your books if they want to get them?
Well, the books...
And CDs.
Okay, yeah. Cody's and Shakespeare's have the books, but they sort of have to come in. Shakespeare's has a lot of back books. The books and CDs. Also, just find me around the Avenue or the Met or whatnot, or write me. Can I give my address? Julia Vinograd, Vinograd, 1630 University Avenue, number 34.
Who knows for how long?
Yeah, really, cross my fingers. Berkeley, California, 94703. And the books are $5, a dollar for postage, and the CDs are $15.
Great. Julia, thank you for the latest poetry.
Okay, hopefully that's enough.
Never enough.
You caught me a little flat-footed. I just cleaned out my notebook so I wasn't carrying too much with me.
Thanks.
And that was Julia Vinograd, whose poetry you can find usually in Cody's bookstore up in beautiful Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue, or you can leave a message on the Huff line and I'll have her get in touch with you. She's done, as I said, more than 40 books. Really wonderful stuff. I have not been able to listen to it because I've been running around preparing for the interrogation of Uncle Mike Rotkin, who has not yet reached the studio, but we have hopes he will be here shortly. However, in the studio with us, we do have two panelists. Actually, we have one panelist and our timekeeper. One of the panelists is Steve Argue. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
And timekeeper Jennifer Gosk, who was last seen on this station, or heard on this station, interviewing Robert Whittaker, of the author of Mad in America. Hey, Jennifer.
Top of the morning to ya.
Now, that horn sound you hear is going to be the two-minute warning for our council member, who is going to be asked to answer questions in a timely manner, as most of us are required to do on such occasions. And the panel is going to be, I would suspect, rather firm with him. But again, we're trying to make sure that the issues get out, assuming, of course, that the candidate, or I should say the council member, gets here. We'll see what's cooking with that. That's 96.3 FM is what you're tuned to in Santa Cruz. You may also be listening to us at 101.1. You may also be listening to us at 101.1 FM. It's true. And
was it Apple?
Yeah, it does. Your mic's off. Do you want to be? You want to talk, Mike? Steve, I can turn it up if you'd like. And you were also broadcasting at www.freakradio.org, which is the internet address we have to get out on this whole thing. You can, again, I want to repeat the phone number. You can call in at 427-3772 if you have a question for Mike when he shows up, or I should say a question for the panel to ask Mike, or a question for, I guess, who knows, maybe Mike will be that bold enough to ask the panel some questions. That could happen, who knows, but this is probably, this is the day for Mike to speak on these issues and be closely interrogated, I guess is the word, on these issues. Looks like we got an incoming call here. Let's see who's on the line. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert, Bernard.
Hey, Bernard, what's cooking?
And I have a question for the panel to ask Mike.
Okay.
Ask Mike how he justifies running for on the board of directors for the ACLU when Mike, has supported the downtown ordinances and the sleeping ban.
Hmm. I guess the question is, what kinds of local civil rights issues is he? How's he going to deal with local civil rights issues on the ACLU board, or perhaps like the Bill of Rights Defense Committee people? He doesn't think that's a fit subject for that particular body. After all, Santa Cruz is a pretty near perfect human rights record, right?
I hope we'll ask the panel to ask those two questions, please.
I will. Okay, again, the questions are, how does he justify running for the board of the ACLU with a sleeping ban and the downtown ordinances as accomplishments to his credit?
Yes.
And that's the question you have?
Yes.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
We'll ask it. Again, if you got questions for Mike Rotkin, you can jump in before the feathers start to fly by giving a call to 427-3772, and we will pass it on. A couple of news items. Leela Percival, the woman who is being held in Dominican, whose writ of habeas corpus hearing I attended a couple months ago is now out. I don't have any much more information about it, but I'm going to be checking in with her later. And of course, if she's listening to the show, she's welcome to call in with an update on how she was treated at, I think it was probably 7th Avenue she was sent to after Dominican. That's, I guess, another issue that isn't directly something Rotkin on the City Council control, which is how people who are mentally disabled or labeled mentally ill are treated. But indeed, the police department is given certain guidelines. The City Council does have some input into that situation. There was, of course, the issues of how disabled activists like Happy John Dine were treated, sort of a lead supper on November 12th, 1997, when Dine was shot dead by Officer Connor Carey, and as we talked about on the air last time, there was nothing visible done in terms of any retraining procedures of police that I ever heard about, no disciplinary consequences that I ever knew about ever accrued to Officers Over and Connor Carey. Steve, do you have something to say about this?
And no jail time for murder.
And, of course, there was no prosecution, and hence no conviction or jail time for murder. The officer who shot woman, the 4-foot, 7-inch woman in San Jose who was wielding the dangerous vegetable cutter, the Vietnamese woman, apparently came from Santa Cruz. It was Officer Marshall. So he was a former Santa Cruz police officer, apparently. They let him go just in time, or maybe, who knows. I mean, the Vietnamese community is pretty much up in arms about that slaying, which, of course, Marshall was exonerated by a grand jury. But, again, there's some of us, naysayers that we are, who kind of look at what seem to be the pretty clear facts of the case. It was an open grand jury hearing. I didn't attend any of the grand jury. I just read about it in the papers. But it sounded pretty questionable to me. Police officer heavily armed and, protective gear and equipment entering a room where there were children present, shooting dead a woman with a vegetable peeler. And there had previously been calls when, problems had been resolved. It's just one of those stinky ones, Aha! The culprit has arrived. Councilmember Mike Rotkin is in the studio. And now we got to do is get our second panelist here, and we'll be so happy. Perhaps she's been delayed. So So what's going to happen here is I'm going to kind of stall this a little bit longer so we can get our entire panel set up. Welcome, by the way, Mike, to the studio.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. If you'd like a glass of water, everybody grab a glass of water if they'd like. We've got cookies here. There's medical marijuana available for those who... just kidding. We don't allow that in our studio. We only break certain laws here. You know, we don't break all laws. So... again, the number to call in if you want to be a part of, give some questions to the panel so they can, further deconstruct Mike Rotkin here, is 427-3772, and the email address is rnorse2@hotmail.com, rnorse2@hotmail.com. I'm actually going to check the email, which is something I keep forgetting to do, but so far we have no email, so don't blame me if... I don't ask your question because you've got to get it to me. There are a series of meetings at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, actually all at the same time. There's, of course, the second session of the City Council meeting. There's meetings at the police station around downtown neighbor issues, the police station community room. And there's also an ACLU Board of Directors meeting, which I guess Mike Rotkin is on the... You were elected to the Board of Directors of the ACLU, right, Mike?
Yeah, great.
And
I have a conflict. Your chair's over the cord, Robert.
Okay.
And
there we go.
Yes, I'm on the ACLU Board of Directors.
Now, did you have opposition, Mike, when you were running for the board? Did anybody say, what are we doing electing a man who passed the downtown ordinances? Nobody came up with that one?
Strikingly enough, no one said that.
And were you the only person elected? Was there a full board?
Yeah, there's a slate was put forward, and voted for all at once. So it wasn't like individual elections or contested elections. There were no, as far as I know. Now, there were elections held recently, about 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, and I was reelected at that, but I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what happened.
So you've been a board member on the ACLU for how long now?
About 3 years or 2.5 years.
And you've been a member for?
Since I was 12.
So you've been a member since you were not out of your swaddling clothes.
Ancient history.
A long time. Now, you know, the ACLU has taken numerous positions on issues. I'm going to do an interview with you until we get to interrogation. I'm waiting for our panelists to show up. I think I hear the tread of footsteps on the... Aha! The other member of our SWAT team has arrived. Becky Johnson is here, so I guess the interview will have to wait. It's on with the show. Becky, you are the controller of the mic over here because you're the one in the middle. I want you to be sure that Mike gets his time, but doesn't go over his time. I want to be sure about that. And the situation is this. Mike has agreed to come in, and we were going to get an hour with him, three, four weeks ago, and he had a personal matter that conflicted, and now he's back. We've got an hour and, I guess, 10 minutes now to roll. Does that sound right, Mike?
Yes.
Okay. And... So panelist is going to propose a question to you, Mike. You are going to be given 2 minutes to answer the question, and Ms. Gosk here is the timekeeper. Jennifer is the timekeeper. As we near the end of the 2 minutes, there will be a gentle honk on the honk machine, which will let all honkies know that time is coming, is ending on that. And then
I suggest, Robert, she could just wave her hand, and then if I go over, she can honk at me, so I have to force this stuff.
Okay, we can do that. We can do that.
Interrupting me with a honk there, just a wave of the hand.
Uh-huh.
Time's getting near here. We'll be fine.
Right. Oh, we'll see how our team gets
a perilous glare.
Well, I would say that the honk is definitely required if it's gone over. Although actually, at City Council, it's a light. We don't have that kind of technology here, but.
And a shut-off microphone,
that too. But Aunt Becky will take care of that, hopefully. All right, so we have, we're playing hardball here, but Mike's tough. He's been in the business for a while. He's walked the precincts. He's talked to thousands of Santa Cruzans. True, Mike?
Yes, that's correct.
And he's faced a lot of hostility in the course of four mayorships. True enough?
No, three mayorships.
Huh, I guess
Five terms on City Council, but three mayors.
Oh, boy. Cheated out of his name. You didn't literally, the first two times you weren't, okay, well, there you are. All right, it will probably end up being four mayorships sooner or later. I think we can probably bank on that one. Barring a recall, of course. Barring a recall. Now,
barring a successful recall. recall.
Correct, correct. Are you, barring a recall, to get, at least get the signatures put on the ballot or a referendum, as we saw, of course, with the De Anza, signatures were gotten together, and then some interesting backroom maneuvering happened, and that didn't make it onto the ballot there. So, okay. For those who are listening, again, you can call in at 427-3772. Your call is going to be screened, and we'll try to give you an opportunity. We'll try to get your call, your question out, and your comment out. But if you really want to make extensive comments, that's going to happen after the show, because we all have a limited time here, and we're rushing along. So there, that's our excuse. Okay. Well, I have a series of questions, but I think maybe we should begin with. Let me begin with a question here. This is the situation. We also would like we want to tell you the rules of the game here are we would like to make sure that there are no impertinent, intemperate, or slanderous remarks directed to the panelists. If you can, please speak to the entire panel. Try not to single out individual panel members. Even those panel, of course, we would appreciate if the and you will have, of course, 2 minutes to speak. I want to assure you that any comments that you make will be very, very seriously considered. We may not be able to take action on them at this time, but we are going to consider them. And so please be advised that's what's cooking. Why don't we begin with a question from our first panelist, Becky Johnson. Go ahead, Becky. And Jennifer, ready on the clock? Okay.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Rotkin. And And I can call you Mike, too.
We'd appreciate it if you didn't interrupt the panelists. Thank you.
Yeah, point of order. You have been quoted as saying that if we legalized sleeping, 10 million people would move here to sleep on our sidewalks. How do you justify making a statement like that?
Actually, I believe my comment was that if we legalized sleeping in the streets of Santa Cruz, that I pointed out that there were at that time estimated, and not everybody agrees on the number, 10 million homeless people, and still probably somewhere between 7 and 10 million homeless people in this country, and that if we legalize sleep, we would be on the streets, we would be the only city in the United States to do so, and that a significant number of those people would come here. I never claim they'd all come here. We're a small town of 50,000 people, and I think the statement's pretty straightforward, and I don't think it's a very difficult one to defend. If you made it, if people were allowed to come here and sleep on the streets and not face any hassle, people would come in their motorhomes. They'd come in cars. They'd get here however they could, and they'd be sleeping on the streets of Santa Cruz. I think that's pretty obvious that that would be the case. I mean, I guess I would return the question, if that's allowed in the current format, why wouldn't they come here? We provide lots of services. It's a beautiful place to live, and they'd be allowed to be on the street. So, I mean, yeah, what I said was there's 10 million homeless people, and an awful lot of them would come here if we made it legal for people to sleep on our streets here.
Now we're going to ask the panelists to discuss Mike's answer. Steve, any reflections? In fact, Mike has returned a question to the panel to ask.
Well, first of all, it's not true that this would be the only city in the country that doesn't have a sleeping ban. There's lots of cities that don't have sleeping bans, it's really the only thing that's nice for people here, as compared to most places, is the fact that that the weather's nice in terms of being homeless. Most homeless people aren't looking for a place, aren't looking for a handout and things like that. I mean, temporarily, yes, but most are looking for a job, and this is not a very great place to be looking for a job, frankly. And this is also not a very friendly place to the homeless. So I think the idea that so many people are going to be flocking here that are homeless, most people stay close to their homes the area they're living in when they're homeless and are looking for a way out of being homeless, not for a better place to be homeless.
Mike's a smart guy. He knows that homeless people generally are within 40 miles of the last place where they had housing, that homeless people don't migrate because of they can get a free meal someplace or there's a nice cushy sidewalk to sleep on. Homeless people migrate for the exact same reasons that people who live in houses migrate. They migrate where they can find jobs, and they migrate to places where they have friends and family who can provide a network of support. Indeed, that's a big reason why homeless people don't leave this area when they become homeless, because they still have friends and family and support networks here, which they wouldn't have in some place like Bakersfield or Fresno, which, by the way, has not solved homelessness there either. This comment, we do have the quote, Mike, that it was, you did say 10 million people would be here tomorrow, which this really grinds me, because I consider this fear-mongering, so that people who, recognize in their heart of hearts that we have an obligation to help the poorest of the poor and people who are down on their luck, and there's a natural tendency for human beings to help other human beings who are in trouble. And yet, Mike gives them the excuse, well, yes, the sleeping ban is very harsh on homeless people, but we need it, because if we didn't, 10 million homeless people would move here tomorrow, and then what would happen to our quality of life? And I would very much like to hear if there's a single example where that's ever happened, where they had a sleeping ban in place, and then that sleeping ban was removed for whatever reason, and then there was a huge migration that followed. It didn't happen in 1986 in Santa Barbara in the 3 years when they had no sleeping ban. It didn't happen in Florida after the Pottinger decision was passed. And there's a much clearer example where a very warm city and area in Florida, south of the Northeast, a very populated area loaded with homeless people. Why wouldn't all those New York homeless people move to Florida the second Pottinger was enacted? But yet social service providers recorded no upward blip in the number of homeless people coming to their services and requesting services. It didn't happen in Oregon, and it was Eugene, Oregon, when they modified their sleeping ban and created a lot of extra places for homeless people to legally sleep at night. Right now we have a situation where there's nowhere outside of the ISSP or the Armory, there's no place that homeless people can legally sleep. We know that 30% of the homeless in Santa Cruz are sleeping in their cars. They don't use the Armory, and there are obvious reasons why they don't. If Mike were homeless and living in his car, he wouldn't use the Armory either. You have anything else, Steve?
I would like to add something as as impromptu furor of this whole scene here. It's already been stated that Santa Cruz has a severe shelter crisis, officially declared three times, in fact, I think a couple of times when Mike himself was on the city council. Tonight there'll be 39 people who will be able to use the emergency shelter program. In 2 days it'll go up to 139, I guess.
Well, there's 75
75
spaces in the Armory.
Right.
And an emergency can go up to 100. And Ken Cole lowered the capacity of the Armory to 75 based on the number of toilets and showers there that really can only adequately serve 75 people. However, Mike has said repeatedly in years past that the Armory could hold 200 people, which was a ridiculous number. It's never held 200 people. And then based on that number, he said that, well, the Armory's never full, so obviously, the sleeping ban is not that punitive, because we have empty shelter spaces every night.
I hear a response from Mike over there. We'd appreciate it, of course, if the members of the audience would retain decorum here. But of course, if there are rare circumstances where if a member of the audience wishes to be recognized, they can raise their hand, and then the panel can choose whether to accept that. But I think that in essence, Mike has passed me a note requesting that. A verbal note in this case, that he be able to make a response. Panel, do you feel that we can make an exception to the situation and allow the guest to make a response here?
Sure.
All right. Mr. Rodkin, 2 minutes. 2 minutes. Go ahead.
First of all, there are homeless people are, there are a lot of different kinds of homeless people and people who are homeless for many different kinds of reasons. And certainly there are lots of people, probably the majority of the homeless people in the country, who are homeless for economic reasons and probably wouldn't go far from their home base. There are also other homeless folks who tend to travel a great deal, particularly in the West Coast, California, up to Seattle and all the way down to San Diego. And we're talking here about probably 100,000 people, roughly, it's an estimate. And those are the people who are most likely to stay in whatever city along this coast lets them stay for as long as they do. And in fact, in Santa Barbara, when they made it legal to sleep on the streets there, they did have a huge problem with more people coming, and that's why they ended their experiment with like letting people just sleep on the streets after 3 years. In Berkeley, California, they opened up a car camping ground for 300 people. It very quickly had 700 people, and they had to close it down because the people who were not able to get into the existing park ended up parking in the surrounding neighborhoods. Finally, I don't think, I mean, Becky made the argument that somehow I'm the one that's sort of giving people reasons for their, you know, to be able to be harsh towards homeless people. But the reality is I think there's a real different set of perceptions here about what people in Santa Cruz think or feel. In my experience knocking on doors in Santa Cruz, it's been a struggle for me to get people to even support the existing programs that we have. Or any kind of things to support homeless people. Generally, people have been very hostile about services for the homeless, don't think it's where their money should go. And the city council has a fight to even get people to support those kinds of services. Unfortunately, we live in a society that's so screwed up that it's hard to get people to support money for schools or for childcare or for senior citizens. And believe me, the homeless folks are not high on the list of things that people want to fund with their tax dollars. So I'm not the one that's providing people with rationales, trying to come up with a rational program and respond to these needs.
I've heard you justify the sleeping ban before, saying that before there was a sleeping ban, the police would just beat up people, beat up the homeless, and leave them, dump them on the outside of town. So is this like the argument of if we beat them a little bit, then they're not going to get such a bad beating? I mean, what kind of argument is this that you actually think that? Keeping people illegal is going to lower the amount of police abuses? It seems like the opposite. When the police approach someone and can ticket them and potentially arrest them for sleeping, making people illegal for the fact that they can't afford a roof over their head puts them in a position of more police abuse.
Wait, let's get the panel to finish this first. rather than have a dialogue with the candidate.
Well, I think it's interesting, Mike, that you talk about the Berkeley car camp and the fact that so many people came to it. You think that's a rationale for not having it. To me, that seems a clear indication that this was a needed service and too small to support the need that's there. I think that, you know, by saying that and then saying, oh, but then we can't get the kinds of compassion to support homeless services, in one statement, you're giving people an excuse for to think poorly of homeless people, and then and then half a second later, you're saying, "Oh, but it's hard to get support for the services." We need to hear you saying, using the public forum and saying to the people of Santa Cruz, "We have a population here that is tremendously disadvantaged. They're harassed and suffering." On a daily basis because primarily because of economic reasons. And those economic reasons are caused by a housing situation here that in all of your terms on the council has only gotten worse under your leadership instead of better in terms of providing housing. We know from the community assessment project, which was done by United Way, now that's countywide, that we need about 20% of the housing in Santa Cruz County to be affordable, and currently we have somewhere around 4% affordable housing. So what I'm setting forth is that the reason that we have so many homeless people locally is because of a failure of government to either to put controls on the free market or to provide government programs that provided subsidized or affordable housing, perhaps rent control, any kinds of means, so that we have the kind of affordable housing that we need in this community. And because of a lack of it, we have people homeless, and you want to spend a lot of police money arresting them for sleeping at night, for covering up with blankets between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m.?
Wait a minute. As a Fuhrer, I wish to make a comment here by jumping into the panel. Also, there are three statements made by Councilmember Rotkin here, which I think are not accurate. The claim that that the Berkeley, I guess was we're talking about the TP the Rainbow Village of the mid 80s, I think is what you're referring to when you're talking about a car camp in the mid 80s. That's the last car camp I remember happening.
I thought it was down by the Berkeley Marina.
Right, that's what it was. If that's the one that's being referred to.
No, that what I'm referring to was actually in the early 90s, and it was up on the up above Berkeley in the hills, and it was a large car camp area that had been created.
I'd never that interesting.
The,
I mean, I was in Berkeley at the time writing on these issues, and never heard of such a thing. But maybe it's possible that a camp for 300 people. I don't think that would have escaped my notice. But you know, I'm not omniscient all the time. The other claim you made had
but not omnipresent.
That's true. Yes. What is I'm trying again? I'm trying to recall the. Homeless and other large urban areas allow this. Of course, Miami has been mentioned. You haven't, and no, there's never been a response either here today or at any time in the past in writing or at City Council to the issue of, as Becky has presented it, to that in fact, lifting sleeping bans does not per se result in, for example, an increase in social services, according to the stats of the social service providers themselves. And maybe this is a factual dispute. And you have information that we haven't seen.
Well, I seem to recall Catherine Byers calling down to Santa Barbara and talking to the mayor and city council members and asking if there was increase in homeless people during that three-year period when the sleeping ban had been repealed. And she said that the mayor told her that there was no increase in homeless.
We also found by interviewing people in Miami, Florida, social service providers, that there was no increase when the Pottinger guidelines were put into play in terms of social service demands by a new population that came into town because of the fact that they're no longer criminalizing people for what they have to do every night.
And indeed, here in Santa Cruz, when the Santa Cruz City Council in 2000 passed on a first reading safe zones in the two industrial areas, Ken Cole, on June 20th, said
Homeless
on the
Resource Center Director.
Said on the Voices from the Village show that he had no increase in the number of people seeking homeless services at the Homeless Services Center at that time.
And it would seem to me that making statements, as I believe Councilmember Rodkin did, rather strong statements against the Fitzmaurice Crone Sugar safe zones, about massive numbers of people coming to town and kind of supporting what sounded to me like a frankly bigoted campaign by the Chronicle and others to misrepresent different kinds of vehicles as somehow coming into Santa Cruz as a consequence of a proposed safe zone is a way of, although perhaps appealing to bigotry in order to prevent a greater bigotry, because I think that to some extent Councilmember Rotkin's point of view is that if you did lift the sleeping ban, this would prompt so much reaction from the community that there would be more anti-homeless feeling, a loss of homeless services. This is at least a claim I've heard Councilmember Rotkin make in the past when he was mayor in 1996. The reason that he moved to shut down protests at City Hall and didn't respond to the concerns about, that went on for month after month, that there was no place for people to sleep in the summer. We believe we're responsible, and this is a claim that he disputes, into at least ignoring, if not colluding, in the closing down of Marini's summer shelter area, at least as mayor, not opposing it, not taking any action to guarantee that there was a broader shelter reality there. I mean, I think my feeling is that Mike is a politician who has to respond to various constituencies in the community, but yet it seems up at UCSC, and in terms of his political writing, Mike represents himself as kind of being a lefty in some ways, a socialist, a feminist, and I'm wondering, it's hard for me to reconcile these positions. If you can't support human rights locally, what does it mean to support human rights elsewhere? That's my commentary on this. Now, and again, I'm not suggesting Mike necessarily respond to this. This is just sort of my interplay, unless he can respond if he wants. Frequently he doesn't respond. If you'd like to respond, go ahead, Mike.
Well, again, I don't usually like to whine about formats, but I would be happy to respond to every single point you made, but I can't respond to every point you made in 2 minutes, because all three of you made in 2 minutes. So you figure out what to do with the format. I will use my 2 minutes to say the following.
Okay.
No, to answer Steve's question, I don't believe that, the police, the reason for having a camping ban is to make the police behave themselves. In the early 80s, when I was the mayor, police were abusing the homeless, and I worked successfully to get 6 officers terminated because of it. We brought assault charges against 4 of them and failed in court. The jury let them off for a variety of reasons. The police need to follow the law and not be abusing people no matter what the heck we do in terms of the other stuff. And so I've never made the argument that the rationale here is to make the police, you know, not be brutal or to not do their jobs. They need to do their jobs. Marini shelter was closed down by the parishioners at the church. I knew about the shelter that was happening at Holy Cross Church. It had been going on for months. I was well aware of it. I visited there several times and supported it. And they closed it down because they wanted to expand the church, and they were worried that their neighbors would be unhappy with them. And the city council had nothing to do with that decision. And there's nothing we could have done to reverse that decision. The neighbors controlled it. I mean, the pressure of the neighbors and the decision of the parishioners made that happen. Santa Cruz has a housing crisis, had one for a long time. We actually have provided a higher percentage of subsidized housing, therefore of rent-controlled and affordable housing, than any other city in California at 11%, not 4%. On the other hand, there's still a major housing crisis here, and I support rent control, but the problem is the people in this town don't. We brought it before them 3 times. If you have a strategy for how we can affect rent control in this town, let me know what it is, because I would be supportive of it. I've been supportive every time it's ever had any opportunity to even go anywhere. Even when I knew it was going down in flames, I got on board and supported it, and we failed every time we've tried to do rent control here. So there's an issue there, and how you're going to make that happen politically, given a town that's rejected it 3 times by larger margins each time. The question of whether we have lost track of half of the comments here, but whether we need more services in town, sure, there's no question that... What's that?
The horn is coming. Here. I want to hear that horn, Kate. There you go. That's a great sound. I like that.
My 2 minutes are up.
All right. So now I'd like to point out, before the panelists begin, I'd like them to address these one by one. First of all, the Marini Church situation. Councilman Rodkin says it was a decision by the parishioners, that he was a supportive of this. What's your reaction to that, Becky?
I don't really remember it that way. I read the Sentinel article that happened right after the Marini's impromptu open-air shelter was closed down. I heard it was closed down by the planning department. And, Mike, you were quoted in the Sentinel the next day saying that, well, he had to do it because we have a camping ordinance that makes it illegal for people to camp outside. So there you were sort of hiding behind the camping ordinance, which we have been critical of for how many years? I think it's passed in 78. I think there's been protests against it since 1978 as being... The kind of ordinance.
For those who don't know what the Marini's thing was an actual campground that was set up by at Holy Cross Church by Father Marini. It was an indoor series of, not even a campground, but it was a pavilion that people could camp in. Right?
The pavilion is part of the ISSP program. What we're talking about was just between the parking lot and the field, there were up to 60 people. It just started out I talked to Father Mike Marini directly about this. And he said that there was this one guy that was sleeping on his porch, and he said it was okay for him to sleep on his porch. Then he brought some more friends, and quickly...
An example of the 10 million phenomenon, perhaps.
Well, I think it just goes to show that if there's any haven there from the cops writing tickets or banging on your vehicle at 2:30 a.m. with a flashlight, that people are going to do it. Look at the Coral Street open-air shelter. That was a little tiny place surrounded by... busy highways and construction, and yet people came out of the Poganip, they came out of the Greenbelt areas to live there just because it was a legal place.
Did Father Marini have a comment about Councilmember Rodkin's behavior in this matter?
Well, he said that Mike had been up there the day before, looking around, talking to neighbors, checking out the situation, and the very next day the planning department came up and shut him down.
And did he have any comments about Mike's attitude in this situation?
He said that Mike is cold.
Cold. Jovial Councilmember Rodkin cold. Any comments on the Marini situation? I know you wanted to say something else.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to a few other things Mike Rodkin brought up.
Can we take them one at a time? Because I want to kind of bat it around as we go.
Okay. Okay. Well, first of all, I want to deal with the question of affordable housing, which I think the claims that that Rodkin's been trying on this are false, and I think the most recent example is what happened with the De Anza residents, and you know, and the claim you know in in taking this rent control away from these residents, these elderly residents, that that the city can't afford the legal costs involved, when at the same time they're involved in police harassment of things like the Blue Lagoon, which has cost $500,000 and plus more money, and you know, considering whether or not to continue this fight and waste more tax dollars on something where it's been obvious harassment of the Blue Lagoon as a bar, with cop cars sitting in front, headlights pointing into the bar, dogs in front of the car, police with or in front of the bar with police with dogs in front of the bar, and other harassments that have gone on. There's a whole lot of money that's found for the police department and for harassing the homeless, for harassing political activists. But the claim here is that there isn't enough money. There isn't enough money for protecting rent control in the one situation where the city still had rent control with these De Anza residents.
Regarding rent control,
and I also want to continue though. Rent control not only has Mike Rockin not tried to institute across the board rent control here in the city.
Not since 1982.
He's done nothing to protect what little bit of rent control we had. And at the same time, we have a problem of too little housing as being part of the problem of why we have high rent here. And part of why that's the case, we have to look at a number of different policies from the city council, one of which is the high-density housing ordinances, which keep low-income housing, apartments, various kinds of housing that some residents fear, they fear might bring the value of their housing down. But these high-density housing ordinances that keep a lot of low-income housing from actually being built here. So I think the city council has failed miserably on these issues, and Mike Rockin really hasn't addressed them on city council, not since 1982 anyway.
I'm a bit concerned about the rent control situation. The idea that one can always drag up these prior votes in 79 and 82, which indeed had diminishing or increasing majorities, but still thin majorities against rent control, as an excuse never to bring it up again, and then claim at the same time that one is trying to, if only someone would bring me a plan similar to Rockin's, I'm sorry to be referring to Councilman Rockin in the third person, but he is a phenomenon in Santa Cruz, so we have to refer to him as a force, not simply as an individual. Similar to, I would say so, similar to I'm losing my train of thought here, but it seems to me you can't, thank you, get the horn, you can't rest on laurels from 1982, kill rent control in 2003, and then claim you're an advocate of rent control. If only somebody would bring you a plan, you'd be helpful. This is the same thing, I remember it now, that was said about campgrounds. If only someone would bring him a campground. Oh, we're investigating that situation. A shelter. Oh, we're looking into that situation even now.
And this is a time between 82 and 2003, the cost of housing has skyrocketed in that time, and the enrollment at UCSC has dramatically increased at that time, further impacting the housing situation locally. To say that, you know, we tried rent control in 82, you know. I don't know. It sounds a little hollow. I wanted...
Before you leave rent control, for example, just eviction protections, renter eviction
protections.
I haven't
heard a word of council about
No, hasn't come up, although TRUSC, Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, has urged it be brought up. Nothing has really come up in that regard.
How about redevelopment money going for community land trust? We've got, you know, an organization ready to go. A little help from the city would probably get started on establishing affordable housing
so
in perpetuity.
I think that we've kind of, I mean, what we're trying to do here is kind of cover the points. Often Mike makes 5 or 6 points in the course of about a minute and a half. He's very, very
I want to take up another one of those points. Another one of the points
he
brought up.
Good.
Similar to the rent control point, which he brings up his actions in 1982 on. Now he's bringing up his fighting of police brutality back in the 80s, when we have many cases of police brutality occurring all the time. and not just police brutality, but police abuses, legal police abuses that occur under the sleeping ban and downtown ordinances. But beyond that, abuses that occur extra legally outside of even the city's laws, like the murder of Happy John Dine that happened in 1997, where Happy John Dine, according to all of the independent eyewitnesses, was not brandishing a toy gun. And according to the Citizens Police Review Board's own report, he was not. They had a very different story than what was put forward by Police Chief Belcher and DA Danner. Mike Rockin did nothing to intervene in that situation to bring these cops to justice, nor has he in other situations. Now we have a situation with the downtown ordinances, which Mike Rockin has passed, which are another form of legalized abuse of poor people and political activists, where right now the city attorney working under Mike Rockin is prosecuting me for having a literature table up for over an hour on two separate occasions. And this is a man who's also on the board of the ACLU. I mean, this is the hypocrisy.
Only in Santa Cruz.
Right, only in Santa Cruz. So I think it's good to call Mike Rockin to task on the fact that maybe, I don't know, I wasn't here in the early 80s with the Operation Code Blue, where the police were actually killing, beating people. And according to stories I heard, people were killed, homeless people were killed. But whatever role he may have played way back then, Mike Rockin has not been playing a role in stopping or preventing police abuses now.
In fact, in every single police budget, which is often the issue, we have millions of dollars in cost overruns for the police department. We have essentially a police chief who, I don't know if Mike has met a police department budget request he didn't like. If he ever met one, I don't know. I haven't noticed it if it's been the case. And it doesn't necessarily mean that's, you know, I mean, one has to look at each particular one, but the issue, there seems to be a pretty knee-jerk response of supporting every police budget, supporting the dismantling of the Citizens Police Review Board, turning it over to an out-of-town attorney who comes down twice a month, and a private police review public safety committee, which looks over stuff kind of behind closed doors, pretty much, although there's an open segment to those public safety hearings. I mean, it seems that there is sort of a pattern here. I mean, am I being unfair to Mike? What do you think, guys?
We have been able to raise a whole number of things in response to what he said. Maybe we should give him a chance to respond here.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, once again, I'll let your listeners be the judge, but it's like, had to take 2 minutes to respond to, like, I wrote down 6 points made in the most recent barrage here.
Kind of
difficult, but I'll respond to a couple of them at least, which I think need response to. The just cause eviction issue. We had a just cause eviction law that we passed in Santa Cruz in the spring of 1982, and the realtors were successful in 10 days in gathering sufficient signatures to refer it to the ballot, because we had a rent control campaign underway at the same time that included just cause eviction. The political decision was made not by us, but by SHAC, the Santa Cruz Housing Action Committee, that was running the rent control campaign to basically get rid of the just cause eviction law and sort of, and simply, you know, focus on the rent control battle, which we lost by 3,000 votes, even though we had more people voting for it than we ever had before. I think the problem is we live in a town that has a lot of small landlords. Unlike some other cities like Berkeley and other places, we have a much smaller percentage of renters, 53% here versus 78% in Santa Monica, 68% in Berkeley. Higher percent in the major cities where they passed it, San Francisco. So we've gotten our butts kicked at the polls on this issue, unfortunately. And it really takes a political campaign to pull together people, not just, you know, from the left or from folks who are sort of ideologically disposed towards rent control, but a much broader campaign. And even having done that, we were not successful in the struggle. And I have been involved in rent control since 82. There was a campaign a couple of years ago that people put on, and I signed up for it and went around speaking on this thing publicly. And once again, we didn't even gather enough signatures to get it on the ballot. It really takes work to make these things happen, not just the will of 7 council members or whatever. And current council, 7 members support the concept of rent control, but have no way to affect it, given the reality that the citizens at this point, at least without some much broader political education campaign, don't seem willing to get on board.
30 seconds.
What else? These other kinds of lists. Oh yeah, the issue of Marini again. In response to the comment about that, it's one of the few times I feel like I've been slandered, because I don't mind people not liking my politics or think I got the wrong interpretation or the wrong values, but it's an absolute lie that I ever had anything to do with closing down the campground that Mike Marini has set up. And Mike Marini never said that I was cold. It's bullshit to have said that.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your promptness on that. Becky, are you lying when you said that Mike Marini said that Mike Rutkin was cold?
Well, he didn't say it to Mike. He said it to other people.
Who, he said it to you, or are you talking about secondhand information?
He said it to Charlie Phillips.
So this is Charlie Phillips' report.
Mm-hmm.
This is not your direct observation.
No, I didn't hear him say it.
Okay, well, then obviously we must contact Mr. Phillips and talk to him about that. I want to clarify the source for Mike here, since it's an important matter for him.
And he was mayor at the time, and he was aware of it, and he did absolutely nothing to keep the city from shutting that down. He could have rallied.
The city didn't shut it down. It was shut down by the church itself. The city planning department had nothing to do with shutting it down. They would go back and check it out. The people who were the parishioners told Mike Marini, that's the people that are the sort of governing body of that church, told Mike Marini, shut this down. We're in the middle of an expansion plan. I was at the meeting when it happened, sitting there in the back, quietly and not involved, and they said, we have to close this thing down because the neighbors are all upset with us and stuff, and we're involved in a building process, and it's going to kill us. Shut it down. The city had nothing to do with it.
Good. Councilor, we will check on that, and I will report at my next...
And our listeners can check. They can go check the July 1996 Santa Cruz Sentinel. There was a front page article, and just...
Although the Sentinel is not always the best source.
Not always accurate.
That's correct. I think once you check a variety of sources, I will try to check that before the next show. We have some questions out from listeners who have been patiently listening and even emailing in. Questions on the phone, questions about housing. What about beach flats? The city destroyed 138 units to erect more affordable housing. Less housing was built in this place, the Dolphin Lee, now called the Nueva Vista Project, a project that used accumulated city money for housing that was available for low income. Are these two separate callers, by the way? Is this a second question? Are they all this? Is this one, and is this another one? It's the second. The second one is well, we'll give you one. We'll give you 2 minutes to talk about that issue.
Well,
Becky,
first off, I disagree with the caller's numbers. To build the Nueva Vista project, they mowed down 63 units, including 15 units at the Rex Court, which were uninhabited at that time. But we could make the argument that for pennies on the dollar, we could have refurbished them and put people back into them, and still had a lot of redevelopment money left over to build more affordable housing somewhere else. But no, the city had to buy up these 63 units, destroy them, build 48, albeit larger units than the ones that were taken down, but $17 million to build 48 units, taking out 63 units in the process. It just, if this is how the city is going about creating affordable housing in the city, this is just a fiscally poorer way of doing it.
Mike, 2 minutes.
Welcome to the real world of what it costs to build affordable housing in a community. We built 40% more bedrooms than in the previous units, because what you had before were slums, and they were not repairable. The people who went over there, you try to fix the plumbing was completely rotted out, the entire building rusted out. Every time plumbers would go over there and try and fix it, and plumbing was leaking, raw sewage leaking out of people's homes. And you go try and fix it, you'd patch it up, and then it would break 6 feet further down the line. And the floors were rotted out. We had people literally falling through the floors of those buildings. They were beyond repair. The city looked, we tried to repair them. We looked at the possibility. We're not idiots. We tried to figure out, is there a way to do this cheaper? And there was not. So eventually we tore them down, replaced them with units that provide 40% more housing than existed before. And yes, it cost a fortune. Nobody can possibly believe these numbers. They don't make any sense. That's the reality of what it costs to construct stuff in the current market. And I wish it were otherwise. I wish we could, get people to do it all on a volunteer basis or something. But the reality is that's what it costs to build affordable housing. And the city was willing to make that commitment and trying to build additional affordable housing now. And again, the problem is we live in a country that hasn't made commitment to affordable housing. Earlier, a question or point was made that, what's the insanity of closing down one campground because it was overcrowded, isn't that the proof that the thing should have existed? It's the proof that there's a need for a regional and national solution to the housing crisis in this country and the homeless crisis, and that no one city by itself can take this thing on and fix it. One campground is not the solution to the 7 to 10 million homeless people in America. It needs to be a whole series of federal commitments, and most recently the federal government took away $125,000 they've been providing to help support homeless shelters. And that's got to be turned around, and that requires something that goes beyond simply pointing the finger at a couple of local officials.
Panel discussion of the Nueva Vista question, and then I guess the other second part of my...
I can't believe Mike's statement that these were slums and not repairable, and that they did some sort of refurbishing study that during, when Cecile Cirillo herself said that there was no study for refurbishing the units. None of the buildings that were demolished were red tagged or even yellow tagged. The people were falling through the floors. If that were true, then they would have been red tagged or yellow tagged. Those were well inspected units.
Remember, this was
just shortly after the whole beach area plan had been put through, and or attempted to be put through, and city inspectors had gone through and inspected every single unit in the beach flats, and anything that could be red tagged or yellow tagged or some units were even destroyed at that time had been done. At this time, both the Dolphin and the Lee were livable housing. The problem was maybe they were very small units. I mean, suppose you took $25,000 per unit to refurbish them. You'd spend something like $1.5 million and have 63 units with what, gold faucets and filigree tile work. To say that these were that there was raw sewage. I'm sorry, if there was any raw sewage, it would have been red tagged or yellow tagged, and there were no red tags or yellow tags. And I know this because we went down and we got copies of all the repair units for the reports that had been issued, and there was no red or yellow tags on any of those units at the time that they were demolished.
Any other commentary on the Nueva Vista question?
Quick response
from Mike Rock. Any objection from the panel? No.
The reason buildings are not red tagged in the Beach Flats neighborhood is because we didn't want the houses torn down that people were living in at the time. We had their houses, the whole place could have been red tagged, and the city council for over years made a decision not to red tag and tear down buildings because it would have moved people out of housing, which as pathetic as it was better than living in cars. So that to now hold it against us that we didn't red tag them is kind of absurd.
Response from the panel?
I think they weren't red tagged because there were no offenses that were red taggable, and they had gone through and they had earlier on and they had come up with a list of items that needed repair, and then the property owners had taken care of those.
What struck me was that there were other buildings in a similar nature that were refurbished nearby, and there was the claim that there was a refurbishing study done when there was no study. To me, was also a telling argument, because if there had been such a study done, it would have been more. Mike's position, I think, would be more persuasive. That in fact, that it's more cost effective or better to proceed with this. It was a preconceived plan that Catherine Byers had in her back burner for a long time that she really liked and was backed by certain key members of the community who had a political pull, and this plan was rammed through to the exclusion of all the other plans, the possibility of spending money that would actually buy land that could build more housing
and
refurbish existing
housing.
Well,
there is that soccer field that right quite close by where the Nueva Vista is, and we said, why not build this affordable housing on this vacant land and then refurbish these units, the 63 units, and then have at least a net gain in affordable housing.
It's kind of ancient history, but the whole process involving a favored housing provider, a monopoly housing provider, Mercy Housing, then called Mercy Charities Housing, in which they held closed meetings that excluded the community. And then when the groups that were actually required by law to be open voted to
the relocation advisory committee
sent the matter back to the city council and said, we don't want this until you have made specific guarantees. Council refused to grant those guarantees seriatim, although I must say Councilman Borodkin at the last meeting insisted that he was going to do that, but it never got into the specific law in terms of the actual law at the very end, where every individual who was living there was guaranteed a place on return first preference.
Anybody not relocated you're aware of? name one.
Well,
I'd like to know who it was, because in fact we carried through on our commitment to do it.
Actually,
this is all.
Well, no,
we didn't do something bureaucratically in the past, but the end result was exactly what you're calling for. Come on.
Well, the report that I received from residents living down there was that many people left. They got $5,000 to leave, in essence, and they went and took their money somewhere else.
They were given a choice.
Yeah, but $5,000 doesn't pay for the kind of affordable housing that they would have had they stayed.
Elizabeth Vogel was offering $42,000, but none of them got $42,000. That was just pie in the sky thrown up there to get
the question
people to
Mike
buy
has,
into
though,
it
is
not delivered.
The question Mike has is very relevant. Do we have the names of people who were forced out? No, but I talked to people who said we had to leave. We were not on the lists. We could not come back. These were people who said this to me. It may have been they were undocumented. It may have been that you know.
Undocumented was not a reason not to be able to come back to those units. That we made very clear, and there was nobody that was.
That was another.
They were undocumented.
That was another controversy, actually, around whether home funding could be spent for undocumented workers.
We found a way to make it work, so that got taken care of, Robert.
Well, obviously they didn't feel it.
We heard from the Western Service workers that there were very few families who were from the Dalton and Lee that actually even applied for the new housing. That most, the vast majority of them, ended up taking their $5,200 and leaving the area. That community was effectively destroyed.
And to say that it was a choice neglects the fact that what was really going on here was a situation of a significant uncertainty for the residents. That is to say, that would Mercy Housing allow them back? Initially, they were demanding that they not have felony prosecutions, that they had no criminal record for 5 years, that their credit record be good. Activist activity, constantly defamed by you and other council members, got Mercy Housing to loosen up its requirements somewhat. But in fact, at the end, there were numerous people who were so insecure about the situation that they did not come back. And that community, as Becky said, was essentially destroyed.
People were given a choice to take money and go somewhere else, or that the city would relocate them for up to 42 months, which is all it took to build the thing, and we would be paying their rent while they were relocated, and they would pay the rent they were paying before, and we would pay the difference, and that they would have first option to come back to the new place. That people made a decision.
First preference. But that doesn't mean they'd be guaranteed. That's not a guarantee.
That was the choice they were given. As it turned out, that people decided to take the money and run is a choice they made. You might not have made that choice. You may think they were being irrational or something. That's what they decided to do. And anything else is patronizing on your part towards them. Mm-hmm. That's a decision that they thought was something that they wanted to do. Now, if it were me, I would have sat around and waited to have them put me back in the new housing. It's great new housing. It's really comfortable. It's bigger than the old housing. Enough bedrooms for all the kids. They didn't choose that. So now let's blame them or blame us because they didn't make the choice you wish they'd made.
Anyway,
how many families?
Mike has made his point, and Becky's mm-hmm. question is how many families?
Yeah, how many families who were previously housed in the Dalton and Lee are still around and one ready to take this wonderful new housing that you spent $17 million building? It's just a tiny fraction.
It was a vanity project for Mercy Housing, is what it looked like to me. Something they decided they wanted to build another one of their projects, and it was essentially rubber stamped by the city council and shoved through, in exclusion of other options.
Well, one more quick thing about it. I do agree with you, by the way, about the that the city should have purchased vacant land and proceeded with it first, and then done stuff in a different order. And I was unable to get 5 votes. In order to do that, the property owners were not willing sellers, so it takes 5 votes to condemn somebody's property.
You recall when you proposed that at council?
Oh, several times over a long period of time, and we had open votes over it, and we were only able to get 4 votes. At one point in the past, Jane Yokoyama refused to join. Another time, Catherine Byers refused to join.
Are you talking about in the early 90s, probably? This is before this issue came up.
Well, but the point is, we had a strategy that I supported and others supported, Councilmember Kennedy at the time, I remember, but I'm not sure who else. I didn't want to defame anybody, but had supported the idea of purchasing the vacant land and then building on that and then moving the people from the bad housing into that before the housing got torn down and so forth. But it takes 5 votes to do it, and we couldn't get the 5 votes. So there's something where you could blame the city council as a whole, but not me as an individual.
Okay, I have to get some more of the history on that, but all I know is by the time that I entered this controversy and those of us became concerned about it in 1998-99, it was. It seemed to still be options, but Byers had determined that she wanted this proposal pushed through, and I think you were supportive of that and pushed it through without other options. There was never a vote during 98, 99, or 2000 about acquiring additional property. That I'm quite sure. Mm-hmm. So, but
well, the panelist wants to move on to another topic.
Okay, can I before the panelist moves on, can I get some questions from the audience who have been patiently listening?
Go
There's
for
one
it.
Member of the audience who wishes to defend Councilmember Rotkin. Let Rotkin speak more. Why is the panel controlling the dialogue? We need have more time to hear Rotkin.
Can I answer that?
Yes, go ahead.
Mike, we wanted you to get a little feel what it's like for the public when we're at city council meetings and when we're allowed to speak for 3 minutes or 2 minutes or sometimes even just 1 minute on topics that are vitally important to us. And then the council goes on and on and on forever and ever talking about it, and we don't ever have a chance to respond. And if we want to, we can raise our hand and not be recognized by the council. We just wanted to have you get a little taste of how that feels. And I can see that you don't like it, and our audience doesn't like it. And so I just hope that you'll keep this experience in mind when you're having council meetings, how frustrating it is for those of us who want to participate in the direction that our city is going.
Other questions from the audience, and I'm going to give them priority at the moment because Mike here has only 15 minutes left. There was a clarification, and I think it was already made, that $1 million was spent on the Blue Lagoon Cafe Lagoon case by
it's
the city.
Be more than that.
And more than that, not 500,000. So it was actually even more than you.
The million.
Yeah.
It's
500,000 is spent by the city side for their
legal expenses
and of the police department for the Blue Lagoon, which probably would have settled for like $25,000 if the city had just admitted their error.
An apology is what Kate Wells said they would originally have settled
for. An apology
for.
And, of course, stopping the practice, but it took a lawsuit to stop the practice.
Because Patty Cipone has a special position of favor in this community. Apparently she's being groomed for the police department's chief, and she apparently was using this for her own purposes to get grants and to further her career. At least that was the claim of the defense in this case. Anyway, there's an email here from a member of the community. On Tuesday, November 18th, Mike Crockett is scheduled to lead the Pledge of Allegiance at a city council meeting. Is this true, Mike? Oh, it says he is.
Probably, but I don't know.
Why should we pledge allegiance to a flag? How about the Constitution instead? The under God phrase violates my rights as one who does not believe in the Christian God. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the phrase is unconstitutional. Why is the phrase being used at council meetings? And will you take a stand and not say under God as you do the Pledge of Allegiance? That wasn't part of the question, but I'm adding that myself.
I have the same problem. Because I teach school, and a lot of times they have Pledge of Allegiance, and I'm sort of against loyalty oaths just generally as being problematic. But one thing that I like to do is replace, instead of doing the Pledge of Allegiance, I like to recite the preamble to the Constitution. And I think that serves that purpose of uniting the class and the people into what our purpose is.
Except who knows the preamble to the Constitution? Probably nobody. Mike Rotkin can lead us in the preamble to the Constitution. But isn't that contradictory? Well, we still have a sleeping ban in Santa Cruz.
Mike, you want
to... Union, establish domestic tranquility, provide for the common...
He knows all the words, folks. So any comments on this?
First of all, it's interesting that the Pledge of Allegiance was established by a socialist back in the 20s as an alternative to people, kind of religious exercises that people had been involved in. And the concept of pledging allegiance to the flag as a symbol for a secular country, to me, makes a huge amount of sense. It's an outrage that under the Eisenhower administration they added the words under God, which totally corrupts the entire purpose of the thing in the first place. I made a decision a while ago when I ran for city council that I was going to try and focus on what I thought were the major substantive issues in trying to improve quality of life in our community. And I'm not about to mount a major fight against the Pledge of Allegiance. I certainly support the Ninth Court's, Ninth Circuit's...
You won't be using the words under God on the next council meeting.
What I do or don't say when I stand up there and lead the pledge is people have to, like, watch carefully to see what goes on. It's a whole show, can I say. But to me, it's not of any great substance. And I've tried to sort of just put it behind me and move on to the things that really matter. It's worth pointing out that I went to school at a time when we used to read from the Bible every morning in a secular public school in Maryland, and got thrown out of school because I refused to take part in the prayers that were going on there. It's completely an outrageous process that they added those two words under God. They don't belong there. People have their own religious beliefs or non-religious beliefs, whatever they are, and they should be allowed to exercise them and not have this foisted on them. So we probably don't disagree much about this
You'll
issue,
be making
except,
this
except whether this is worthy of a major fight, given the other issues that go on, because there are people that go nuts over this question, and I'm going to wait for the Ninth Circuit Court action to sort of have its way and see where it goes. I think if somebody wants to, I would welcome somebody suing the city for not following the dictates of the Ninth Circuit Court. They're prepared to do it. And
are you going
to
follow the dictates of the Ninth Circuit Court, Mike?
I'm going to wait to see what the Supreme Court says.
You're not going to file the dictates until the Supreme Court.
They have this now on their docket. As I said, I think we should really focus on substantive issues. But I'm not... The idea of pledging allegiance to the flag as a symbol
of the United States and what it stands for doesn't bother me in principle. I'm not sure how much difference it makes. And, of course, it's outrageous that people, you know, will fight to defend the flag in the abstract but don't believe in democracy itself in any real way. So we probably don't disagree on this particular issue in the room.
Thank you, Mike. There's another comment from an incoming email. This is from Fran. The panel is talking, and this is in capitals, far too much. Rodkin has only been allowed to respond twice, and then with time constraints. Panel, would you like to talk about that for a few minutes?
Oh, I think I kind of explained why we were having this unusual format instead of more of a standard debate.
Bob Lamonic has a comment. Mr. Norris, your chosen format for the so-called Mike Rodkin interview has been insulting to the audience, absurd, self-seeking blowhardism for you and your panelists, and extremely boring. You all sound like egotistical fools. Rodkin shines as a tolerant diplomat.
Oh, my God.
What a joke, Bob Lamonic. So, Beth, we should continue with substantive issues. I won't insist that we...
Bob, by the way, was one of the people that I worked with on a rent control struggle that happened several years ago, not in 82, but was unsuccessful.
That was in...
And that was for a rent control advisory board.
That was the petition where he was. They tried to remove him from the farmer's market, that Officer Jim Howes tried to remove Bob from the market. Yeah.
All right, I'd like to move on to another question. During the last elections for city council, Mike Rodkin kind of gave me an underhanded endorsement, saying if you believe that medical marijuana should be distributed near a school, you should vote for Steve Argue. After I had come forward and criticized Mike Rodkin and Tim Fitzmaurice and the rest of the city council at that time for passing a zoning ordinance on the distribution of medical marijuana, which outlawed it in most of the city of Santa Cruz, and then at the same time doing a medical marijuana giveaway, actually in an area where, it, according to their own zoning laws, it's illegal because it's near downtown, but most of the city it's illegal, including where medical marijuana had been distributed to hundreds of patients, and this specific site happened to be near a school, which apparently some people think that medical marijuana patients are a threat to children. And I wanted to get back to that. I didn't get a chance in that particular debate to respond to Mike Rodkin there. But do you still continue to put out that endorsement for Steve Argue if you think that medical marijuana patients are not a threat to children?
And I would like to add to that, and this is the same question. There's been a concern about the fact that in 2000 a medical marijuana law was passed by the city, which essentially zones out the clubs that were existing and zoned out clubs trying to come in. And in fact, there has been no new club that's been able to come into the city. WHAM's list is much overfilled. There's like 250 spaces in the club, and I guess they're all filled up, and it's a long waiting list. And there were thousands of people literally before who were using other medical marijuana clubs. But the city council's rules, according to marijuana activists Kate Wells, Andrea Tischler, Anita Henry, and others who have been working in this area for years, have effectively kiboshed the situation for people seeking medical marijuana. When are you going to change this, Mike?
In which order? Yeah, I continue to endorse Steve Argue's your guy. If you believe that we should sell marijuana or distribute marijuana to medical patients next to schools or very close to schools, then Steve's probably your guy. So that endorsement stands. In fact, I'm not aware whether there were other clubs at the time. My understanding was that there was one particular club that was selling stuff. They were one house away from a elementary school. I don't think that medical marijuana patients are particularly dangerous, but I live in the political world where the reality of medical marijuana being distributed a house away from a school is enough to bring a government down. So from my point of view, whether or not it's rational or whether or not it's a major concern for parents that was going on, the perceptions about that, I think, were non-sustainable. And there's, in my mind, no question that the whole city council would have been recalled on the basis of it if we hadn't responded to it. And it's... the city, we basically try to create a zoning situation where people can distribute medical marijuana in places where we can defend it and we're unlikely to get direct kinds of assaults that will be politically unsuccessful. So we banned it on Pacific Avenue and we banned it in residential neighborhoods, but it's allowed in industrial and commercial zones except for Pacific Avenue, and that's a lot of places you could rent property. Now the next problem is going to be how can you persuade any landlord to actually let you lease a place and distribute medical marijuana from there. That's not the city council stopping folks. That's, again, people's perceptions of how they're going to be perceived by their neighbors and other people. And the medical marijuana struggle, and this is emblematic of a larger issue that I'll just say briefly. We probably all agree on medical marijuana, and for that matter, maybe the normalization or the legalization of medical marijuana, which is my view. But the question is, what can you actually accomplish in practical ways and actually affect it and not get your ass kicked? And that's the political question that you have to address if you want to make a difference in the world. And on that issue, we differ greatly, because your view is you can talk about these things, you can make abstract demands for everything, and my view is, having been there, it's not something you can be successful at, and you will end up compromising to get things affected that do make a difference. And we're trying to provide medical marijuana support for folks and doing, I think, about as far as you can go and still maintain public support.
Becky?
Yeah, well, first off, the ordinance that you passed is so restrictive. For it says that you can only have medical marijuana patients employed to do the distribution, but they're not allowed to use their medication on the premises. So then you got to transport people somewhere else so that they can take their medication. I understood it was that restricted to the industrial zones and agricultural areas, not that any commercial zone other than Pacific Avenue was allowed. It was, and the proof is in the pudding. No club has opened since you passed this ordinance. It actually has resulted in less ability for people to get their medication, and that you're going to get recalled. Excuse me, the city of Santa Cruz passed Prop 215, what was it, 76% in favor of it, and you're going to get recalled because of passing an ordinance that allows legal distributions to be set up in reasonable areas in the city, say like where you have a Long's drugstore or a Walgreens. I think that's fallacious and would not happen. And that the reason the ordinance is so restrictive is that you went behind closed doors with the police department and they whittled it down and made all these restrictions, and then you just rubber stamped them.
It should also be said that Oakland and San Francisco have much different distribution policies. In San Francisco, there are plenty of places across from schools that allow it, not to just distribution of medical marijuana, but you can actually use it on the premises. Santa Cruz is supposed to be more conservative than either of these communities. I don't think so. It's the city council masquerading under progressive labels that is actually more conservative, beholden to the police department and the city managers and the actual institutional structure of the city that has come to these decisions. Calling it practical politics, calling it our experience, you can't, these abstract principles about human rights and justice, you find you have to make these compromises when you get into office. Well, FM coming up, Bathrop Spears Broadsides, a 10 o'clock debate with council member and mayor, well, former mayor, Mike Rodkin. Stay with us. ¶¶